When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I am with Dave. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Today's topic is austere surgery. And since this is the first time on our podcast, would you mind just doing a quick introduction of yourself?
Sure, not at all. So I'm a general surgeon by background. I've been a surgeon now for about 18 years. In that time, I did a surgical critical care fellowship. I've had a kind of an interesting career in that I started on active duty military. I was in the Army. And then got out for a period of several years and was able to work in sub-Saharan Africa and some other areas as a general surgeon. And then I came back on active duty about 7 years ago. So I've had sort of two military careers and in the middle of that, working mostly for NGOs overseas.
Nice, nice. Well, you're definitely you're the perfect guy to talk to about austere surgery, especially sub-Saharan Africa is not super populated from what I understand.
It's quite populated. So in that area, I think the numbers are there's 2 million people to one trained surgeon. So there was quite a need. So part of the job was to train surgical residents while I was there.
Nice, nice, nice. Well, just kind of jumping in, what I'd like to know is what is the real difference between, a surgeon in, a first world country, Western trained surgeon versus kind of what you're forced to deal with in the austere environment, just so I can kind of start wrapping my head around kind of what is required.
Sure. I would say in a lot of ways it's similar, and in some ways it's drastically different. The developing world surgeons are often tasked with providing surgical care for patients that often they've come, it's taken several days to get to the location. So there's no golden hour for trauma. Often it's a golden week. And so your patients arrive in a different state of pathophysiology. Often they're not in hemorrhagic shock. Those patients have usually not survived that process. So they often come in some form of other surgical distress from a traumatic standpoint. They're resource limited. And so there's a lot greater emphasis that we typically see here in the States with regard to conservation of material, particularly suture and supply. Often the patients are required to purchase those themselves. And so they're also very frugal. And then at times, the equipment itself is more austere, depending on how austere of a setting that you're set up in. In some settings such as, refugee camps, you may not have, it may be very similar to a military Role 2 setting. There may not be adequate electrocautery, suction, lighting sometimes is suboptimal, and then the buildings are often buildings of opportunity, that were not initially purposed to be a hospital.
Yeah. So, like you mentioned, logistically, obviously you're going to be constrained, especially if you're having to buy things on the economy. What about like just improvisation and things like that?
Sure. I think one of the things that improvisation, you know, one of the things that I learned was that chest tubes for chest drainage are often in short supply. And one of the improvisations was just to use suction canisters for a single or two or three bottle suction versus the atrium apparatus. And so being able to understand how that functions, and you can use those over and over again versus a single use, you know, atrium or other name brand chest drainage device. The suture often is utilized in a much more there's a lot more instrument tying just to maintain the length of suture. Improvisation, you know, I think a lot of it is much of the austere surgery requires you know, non-minimally invasive techniques. So even some of the techniques that you use that were popular in the West, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they're still required. You know, there's a lot more external fixation for orthopedics. There's no very little minimally invasive surgery at times. And so things that, you know, things like appendectomies, cholecystectomies are done open. So that overall, I think improvisation is done, but most of it is fairly similar as far as the art and practice of surgery. It's, there are excellent surgeons in the developing world that have to do make more with less, and they do often a great job.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as soon as you mention, like, you know, we're out of something, we need to improvise. Sometimes you see guys' eyes light up, like, now is my chance to MacGyver. How do you know what you is, it's okay to improvise, what is not? You know, like, you know, we talked before, you know, we don't have retractors. Okay, so we have some metal spoons, you bend them, you can still sterilize them because they're stainless steel. Like, that makes sense that you can get away with that. But what, how do you draw that line?
Sure. I mean, a lot of it you have to with your team, especially if you're not there full time, if you're working with an NGO or you're part of a surgical team, those decisions are best made before you have to use them in extremis. So a lot of the pre-planning is when we get to the situation, what cases can we do? What can we not do? And then when can we not offer? When is our supply in such limited amount that we're a liability to the patient in that population versus an asset? I would say you can ration your surgical instruments up to a point. Sterility, I've used everything to include regular autoclaves to the, you know, steam charcoal fired autoclaves, and often, you know, that fits in a little pail, and so you may get six instruments in a set of maybe four laparotomy sponges for an exploratory laparotomy, where that same case back home you may use 20 instruments and 30 laparotomy pads. So certainly you can do a lot more than you think with the material you have. You know, I think from an improvisation standpoint, reading history, being able to go back and see what was done in the past. And there's a great book by Dr. Emily Mayhew called Wounded that's on the First World War that talks about the surgical management of patients, you know, in much larger numbers than we typically saw in previous conflicts. And being able to understand what's done in the past is often we don't do it because we didn't have patients in that number, but particularly for the future, understanding your history is important. If you're a budding surgeon, I would recommend reading Guerrilla Surgeon, Parachute Ward. There's a whole genre of literature, particularly from the Second World War, where physicians were, and some of them not surgeons, were required to operate in austere environments, and improvisation was the name of the game.
Yeah. Kind of going with that training, you know, manpower, and you know, obviously you want a full surgical team to have your capabilities as high as possible. That may or may not be possible for a variety of reasons. Like how do you, how do you determine manpower other than like, we've shown up, this is who's here, this is what we can do now?
Sure. Certainly training before you go. And I think a lot of surgical management in austere settings, sometimes you have a novel team where your first assistant may not be in the operating room every day, especially in the military. And so being able to have a resilient learner, I think going back to, you know, some of those books we just talked about, a lot of those teams were selected based on their motivation and how well they worked in small teams, but they weren't necessarily medics by trade, but by the end of the conflict, they could operate independently. And so I look for, you know, in a first assistant, someone who's motivated, who learns to anticipate what the surgeon's next move is, how to handle the instruments correctly, and just understands sort of the basics of surgery with traction, counter-traction, improving the lighting. And then it's sort of like a dance once your partner understands. And the more you do it, the better you become and the more efficient you become. A lot of it's adrenaline. It's not necessarily adrenaline. There's a lot of cortisol involved, especially if you're in an environment where there's a lot of turnover. And so crew rest and making sure that you take care of your team properly is important, because if you're down, the capability of that team is down, and then you know, patients are affected by that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, after you've, as far as like supplies, manpower, things like that, you know, procedures, like how just having, you know, one or two less people than maybe you normally would, maybe instead of a fully trained, you know, surgical first assist, now you're stuck with me, right? How does that affect what procedures you can do?
I think it requires a lot of patience, and not for, with you to me and vice versa, because we don't necessarily work together. Your setting is suboptimal often. And so understanding the environment, I think, is really important, because surgery is hard, and then you add austerity, you add different environments. Sometimes the temperature's cold. You can't control the environment. Your patients have been in a longer state where they're in, you know, they may already be in shock, in septic shock from open fractures or from fecal peritonitis. So they're sicker patients, and therefore your mortality rates go up, your morbidity rates go up, and it's harder to recover in the post-op setting than it would be in, you know, at home in a first world environment. So your assistants, you know, they're able to, a good assistant's going to be able to, like I said, anticipate those needs. But there is a lot you can do. You can do bowel resections. You can control contamination. You can irrigate, debride. I think of craniofacial surgery with fractures. There are some basic dental procedures that you can teach even non-surgeons, you know, and general surgeons alike. Obstetrics. A lot of surgeons, especially general surgeons, don't do a lot of C-sections anymore, but that's a big portion of surgery in the austere environment, is understanding obstetric surgery, and can be a huge impact to the community where those babies would otherwise not survive. So, and then I would say just reading and discussing and being really honest with yourself and your team on how you can improve, because if you think you're perfect, you're not. And but you've, some days you've got to just put one foot in front of the other and understand that tomorrow's a new day and we're going to keep going on and we're not going to quit.
Absolutely. You know, and to throw one more complication onto already a, probably a bad situation as it is, potential for the need to move. And that can be, we need to move because we're going to transport the patient to another location, or that could be, we need to move because this is, this location we're at is no longer safe for a variety of reasons. Right. So, like how, like you can't, I would imagine you can't just stop, you know, like, do you have like anticipated or like, halfway marks or something like that, where like, if we need to go, this is a point that we can stop. I won't say close things up, but package things up to another location safely.
Right. Yeah. There's particularly with trauma surgery, the operational constraints as far as how much time you have, and that may be based on having multiple patients or having to be told, hey, you have 30 minutes. There's typically in a patient, a trauma patient, there's a 1 minute solution, there's a 10 to 15 solution, and then there's an hour solution. So it's kind of good, better, best. And it's up to the surgeon and then honestly the command around them to understand that environment, because sometimes the best operation doesn't keep the team alive, or maybe it won't keep that patient alive. And so knowing where to stop, but certainly that's part of the non-surgeon communication to the team is, hey, how much time do you have to go? We've got to get packaged up. And so often in a trauma standpoint, that may just be obtaining hemorrhagic control and packing, which is easier said than done. But if you think about it from an adaptation of TriC, it's internal tourniquets. We'll deal with the other things later, but we've got to move on to the next stage and treat and route. And so I would say that trauma surgery and austere surgery is a game of inches like football, and there aren't any major complex moves. Typically, they're just layups and free throws. That's what wins the game. And controlling the clock, understanding that time is every bit as important as your meticulous placement of a tie or suture or clamp. That time to the left and to the right of moving those patients in a dynamic environment is very important. And that may be time to getting into the abdomen, but it's also time of getting through the front door or getting around a barricade. And if you've got to go an extra 500 meters to get to the recess bay or the operating room, maybe you need to knock some walls down to where you're going, you know, 50 yards, because that time is time and time is tissue and life. So it's really important. Packaging patients for transport should be practiced over and over again. You'd hate to make $1,000 move in a nickel shot because all of your tubes and lines and drains got ripped out as you're moving from one platform to another. And that requires having situational awareness, securing your drains. I'm a big fan of suturing anything in that needs to stay in. And then anyone who's not bagging a patient or with a hand on a litter is holding on to those interventions, whether or not it's, you know, an airway or a chest tube or whatever, an X-fix, so that, and they don't have to be skilled. They just have to say, you have to say, put your hand here, hold this, and don't let go until I tell you. And the most dangerous times for a patient that's sick, whether or not they're in a hospital or in a tent, is when they're moving. So that's in the hospital, that's in the elevator, the CT scanner, right? Or it's moving back and forth from the OR to the ICU. In the austere setting, it may be moving to a truck or moving to another room in the dark. You know, you'd hate to do something great and have your team trip over a tent pole that's sticking up that you could have seen in the daylight and marked with the chem light. So those little moves are important.
You know, you mentioned like packaging requires training. Essentially, you want to train on every component with individual attention, I guess, if that makes sense, if you wanted to break it apart. That training doesn't just fall out of the sky. You know, if I can't get to a course, or I can't get to, or just have this experience due to the nature of my job, how do I go about looking for that kind of experience? What even kind of experience should I be looking for?
Sure. I would say within the military community, there's always mentors that you see. And a lot of, when I was growing up, is I would see someone, I'd go, I want to be that person. And I'd go up and talk to them. I would hunt them down and say, what do I need to do to be you? And so that's important, is finding those mentors in the profession. And then two, you can mentally do the same case. And we do this with our surgical residents. You know, we work with military surgical residents, and we'll have them present a case on a Monday morning that they did over the weekend. And then go and back up after the case, that, you know, AAR of the case is done, and say, okay, change that same case, but put that in this geographic location or this, you know, relevant scenario. How would you do that differently? Or if you only had 5 instruments to do that case, could you do it with that? And just constantly, you can't always be in the austere environment, but you can think about it. And it doesn't mean that you cut corners at home. You certainly shouldn't practice on your patients and do, surgery with a Leatherman because you can. You shouldn't. You should be meticulous and precise and excellent in your care and the delivery of that management. But you can think about all those things from pre-op to post-op and translate that into the environment. I would say in training, so much of the success of an austere surgical team is not in the surgeon's hands, but it's in the hands of whoever has the operational control of that environment. And it may not be a medical person. It may be a medic. But understanding just those, when you talk about, okay, let's do our MassCal plan and really go through the weeds of that, you know, go through every possible injury for an individual patient, have each team member pull those things out of their bag to understand where they are in the shelves, and to do it over and over and over and be obsessive compulsive about it. You're paid as a surgeon, and as a, particularly in the military, you're paid to be a pessimist, and you're paid to think of the worst case scenario everywhere you go. And you should be, especially when you're about to deploy or deploying, you should be switched on, and that switch should not turn off. That's a blessing and a curse, but that's the line of success. Is you, hopefully the, you know, top 3 or 5 scenarios that you're faced with, you've had time to think about and plan for and go through your equipment. And then, you know, those rehearsals pay dividends later on down the line. So a good training course would anticipate those things. And I think of things like aid and litter teams. Not only should you know that you need 4 people, or however many people that you want, you need the phone number of those people. You need where the truck keys are kept. You know where, what the gate combination is. All those little things that shave seconds off of patient, you know, time to OR and out of the OR to another level of care. They're very important.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned improvisation, and maybe I don't bring out my Leatherman into surgery. But, you know, at the same time, you're in those environments, you're in an austere environment. It is a very hectic situation. You're having patients that, you know, if I just had maybe this stuff, or if I just had this much more time, or whatever the case may be, I could positively affect that patient's life. How do I go about saying, this is what I can do, and stick to it versus allowing myself to get pulled into, well, I'll just try it anyway.
Sure. I would say if you have limited exposure in something to the point where you're thinking of a new surgical technique, you're probably not inventing something new. You're probably doing something that's been tried and didn't work. And so the austere environment is not the opportunity to try something that you have no expertise in. But I think pre-reading, and then that most of the time the internet's everywhere. And a phone call is great. I still call people at 3 a.m. when I'm home. I love getting help. When you cross a busy street, hold hands with as many people as possible. For the military, you have the advisor line to call. And you can call that as a surgeon. A non-surgeon can call that. There's always somebody on the other end of that line that should hopefully be willing to help. And I think, but it's always good sometimes. And sometimes it's good to step away and think about it and reflect. Make a phone call or just think, is this something that I have to do it now or can I wait? And if the patient is going to lose their life or a limb or eyesight, and I absolutely have to do it, sometimes you've got to step forward. And your surgeons are often uncomfortable doing new things. That's common. There's always that anxiety. You're never in your practice going to be in a situation where you have full control over the situation. That's just the nature of the trade. But you also have to have some surgical courage to do things that you haven't done before, especially if the patient's life depends on it. For me, a lot of that was obstetrics. I hadn't done a lot of C-sections. And so I had to learn really quickly how to do things like how to place a spinal. You know, surgeons don't do that. And I've had to do that. And it was anxiety provoking to think if I don't put the spinal in this lady, she's going to lose her baby and she may hemorrhage to death. And, but there was a big part of me that thought this could go really bad. So, you know, those situations, I think you've got to really think about it before. And then for me, I'd literally step aside and find a quiet place and pray. And, I mean, there's sometimes you ask a higher power for help. And I often did that. So,
yeah, wise move, I think. How do I say it? You ever hear a term like the N of one, right? Where, it's always like a heroic story where somebody needed something, nobody else was willing to do it, and one guy stood up and did the thing, and then, the child lived, and, now they're the hero. Everybody, I think, wants to be that, right? But it's like, you have a severely traumatized patient. I have one unit of blood to give. Maybe I buy them another 30 minutes, let's say. How do I kind of determine, do I keep that unit of blood for myself, even though I'm not using it now and there's no other patients to put it into? Or if I give it to this person, it may make a difference, it may not. And now I have none.
Sure. Sure.
How do I go one about?
That's a great question. First of all, we tend to think about blood consumption in the form that you hear stories of patients that were so injured they used 30, 40 units of blood. And certainly we see that. But there are also patients whose lives have been saved with a single unit of blood. I wouldn't negate the oxygen carrying capacity of a large bag of whole blood. And I've seen it work especially I think in the austere setting, you know, you really see physiology change with your interventions in a much greater and more, you could appreciate it better because those patients, you watch them go into class 1 to 4 hemorrhagic shock before your eyes. And sometimes you're checking their pulse or you know, you're seeing that, you're seeing them lose consciousness. You don't see that in a first world ICU because those patients are sedated, they're intubated. You see that on the monitor, but you don't physiologically appreciate it, or it's more visual when you see the color drain out of them and you realize the life is leaving them. The other side of that is when they get a unit of blood, fresh, warm, whole blood, I've seen patients wake up after half a bag of blood that were in hemorrhagic shock and go, "What happened? Where am I?" And survive with just a single unit or two of blood. So that unit of blood, they're hard to come by. What we did in lots of the places where I worked was the volunteer staff would give blood as they could, but often, you know, I would sometimes tap people to give 2 units within a few hours and they feel horrible and then they can't do their job cognitively. A unit of blood, you can still work, can still think. 2, especially in hot environments or high altitude, it's a challenge. So we would tap the family or the community and go, "Hey, we're willing to go all in, but we need donors." And often it takes one brave first person to donate and you'll have a line of people. And where you had an hour ago, you had a single unit of blood, you may have 12 units right there waiting on you because it's there's a community response to that. And when it happens, it's really neat to be part of. And whole blood, developing a walking blood bank is important. It's also, you know, you've talked about it at length before, but that's a great asset for an austere surgical team. But typically the team is engaged in a work, so that capability has to be trained. And I've trained cooks, all kinds of non-medical personnel to do it, and they're great. A lot of times we've gotten blood within 10 minutes from people who had never seen whole blood or didn't know it existed, you know, before you got there. So it's certainly doable.
Yeah, it's 100% doable. Just about anybody, as long as they're willing to learn, can be trained how to do these simple things. And it also kind of empowers them and gives them something that they can do, I guess, versus stand here, carry this, hold that, which you obviously need at times. But if it feels like this is an important thing, you can watch somebody's kind of personality and whatever mental state they're in, like change, you know, from being passive to active. What the frick do you bring? Like, you know, you're going to go to a location, there is, you know, they got some outbuildings that you're going to occupy. You know, how do you even decide? You know, you're going to an austere location. Let's say maybe one of your trips to Africa. How do you decide? Because you have an idea, right? I'm going to see trauma. I'm going to see snake bites. I'm going to see, you know, pregnant women. But there's always, especially in a place like that, there is some crazy stuff that I promise you never thought of that is going to come
your
way.
Absolutely. Yeah, you'll see it one time and never again. That's the nature of a lot of those locations, especially with some of the endemic diseases. I would say there's a difference between trauma-based austere surgery and, sustained, prolonged. You're there in a location and you're working in a refugee camp. You're working in a, you know, where they're displaced personnel to where you're in it. That's a completely, there's a huge difference between those two missions. One is a, you know, typically a brief, you know, the way we think about it is if you're carrying a single ruck in, you're able to provide limited surgical capability to one or two people for a very limited amount of time. And so the logistic train, you've got to pre-plan that, especially if you're going to treat people. You can use an economy of equipment, but surgery does require a fair amount of supply. I would say from a surgical drape standpoint, from bedding, using cloth material is helpful because you can wash it and reuse it and use the sun and UV light to sterilize it. That's a lot of things. Sterile gloves, we would re-sterilize. I would refer anyone interested to go to the JTS's clinical practice guideline on wound care. There's also one on austere surgery that's very good. It goes in some of the specific details of that. But the equipment from an anesthesia standpoint, you've had great anesthesia providers come through that are some of the best in the world at austere surgery. But often there's a limited supply of oxygen. You know, you've got an oxygen generator, but oxygen may be hard to come by. And so providing, total IV anesthesia, I think, is important, having your anesthesia providers understand that concept. And then, you know, just like we've talked about before, mixing your drips in such a way that you're conserving that and not using the entire bag for a single patient is important. From a post-op standpoint, just the nice thing about austere surgery, there's typically not a lot of distance to travel around. And so you're around your patients in there. You may see them 15 times in a day, so you can catch trends earlier. And it's unbelievably rewarding when you see patients that you don't typically think would survive and they do survive. The flip side of that is it's very difficult to see your patients not survive. And so being able to have the ability to, for me, it was running. I would get away and run for, you know, a certain amount of time just to kind of get my mind off of something and put one foot in front of the other to where I wasn't engaged in it. But having some ability to sort of de-stress is important for the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the nature of life is at some point it ends, and sometimes it's going to end a lot faster than what we want it to. And, you know, like you mentioned, you're seeing these people every day. And even if it's not a person, you know, like you engage with every day, you see them in their just normal patterns of life doing the same thing every day, generally. And so when they're gone, you notice. How do you prepare yourself? How do you prepare your team for that eventuality?
That's a difficult question, Dennis. I think it's hard. I've been a doctor now for a while, and it doesn't get any easier with time, unfortunately. I think that there's the movie Moneyball, where one of the managers says, "I hate losing more than I love winning." And I hate to lose. I hate to lose patients to the point where you think, "I don't know, is this worth it?" But it is, and you have to understand the long game of it can be emotionally distressing for your team. Often it's not during the event. Often it may be further on down the line when you're home. But giving your team that extra grace, especially a lot of austere teams are in close confines, you know, they're not around their families. And so giving them a little bit extra grace to know that people handle those stressors differently. And then just, you know, it's a common principle. If somebody's struggling, insulate them, don't isolate them. is huge. And I would say some of the events and trips that I've been on in the past, I'll still to this day call those teammates or text them and check on them on anniversaries. And I got a text this morning from one of my anesthesia buddies that I had done a trip with that I haven't seen in probably 2 years. So it's a daily thing, but I think, and two, just as trite as it may sound, love other people, love your team, love your tribe. It's a lot funner when you care. And I would say it should bother you when it doesn't bother you anymore. Certainly the most loving thing to do is to not have an emotional event in the middle of a resuscitation or operation, because you've got to be able to put that aside. But we're human, we're made that way. And I think that's a very important part of the process, to understand that, you know, you're going to see a lot of bad things, and you can handle more than you think. It's amazing. A lot of times the people that you work with, that's the life that they've lived their entire life. Some of the happiest, most thankful people I've ever seen were in a refugee camp, because they're not getting bombed anymore. They're not getting attacked. You know, they were victims of a genocide, and now they're free. So they're in a horrible environment, you think, and they're happy. And so to see that, it just gives you a frame of reference to be really profoundly thankful to be, for most of us, to be in a setting that we have excess, and we to be thankful for that. And then just with the job, to find joy in what you do is important, because it'll sustain you long term, well beyond the interest of potentially trauma surgery or the practice of medicine. You may burn out from that, but if you still enjoy caring for people, you'll stay in the practice.
Perfect. I think that's a perfect place to end this. Hopefully we can do another one, I think, on this topic, hopefully in the future. But again, thank you very much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.